farmer who in fact
Hello? Hello? Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, yeah, so, you know, this was a discussion, but the psak halacha is that it's mutter. Yeah. Yeah, she can work on it, yeah. Yeah. Okay, see what.
And it's just incredible what they thought journalism was supposed to be about. And well, I think a lot of them are under the assumption that being a journalist is solely a thing of celebrity, right? It's more about making money, being a public figure. Myself, who wants to even care about it? But your job isn't necessarily to inform the public. It's more to entertain the public. And yeah. So you kind of have to, you have to switch that. Like mindset, so they understand the importance of what they're learning and what they think they want to do in the future.
Yeah.
Look, they're entertainment journalists, and they're purely to entertain. Okay, because we don't need to know about what they're doing. Why is that important?
That's most of it.
Right.
And you, if you're an attractive female celebrity, you can't host an award show in a skin tight dress without it being all over Facebook, the recommendations and everything. Oh my God, Kendall Jenner showed her underwear on Snapchat. That's what her Snapchat is. Why is that news every time she does it? Oh, Miley Cyrus licked something.
That's
the middle of Perek Chaf Dalet. Yeah, I think the last thing we're looking at is Pasuk Yud Zayin. Again, a very famous Pasuk. Binafala Yevecha Al Tismach. Do not rejoice upon the downfall of your enemy. Uvi Kashlo, and in his stumbling, Al Yogel Yevecha, your heart should not be joyous. Ten Yira Hashem, lest HaKadosh Baruch Hu sees your glee and your joy. V'rabi Einav, it will be bad in God's eyes. V'heishiv, may Allah apo, and Hashem will remove from him his anger, and the unstated implication is he will put it on you by the joy that you have in someone else's downfall. So we discussed, again, just to go over very, very quickly, we discussed the fact that Chazal say that this is when the Malachi Ashares wanted to say Shira to HaKadosh Baruch Hu during the drowning of the Egyptians in the Red Sea, and HaKadosh Baruch Hu said, Maisa Yadai Tavu Bayam, my creatures are drowning in the sea, Vatemonim Shira, and you are rejoicing. And the Pasuk is quoted, Binfala Yavecha Al Tismach, do not rejoice upon the downfall of your enemy. Now, it is true that some say, although I think it's difficult from the Gemara, that some say, I think you made the point last week, that some say that this is not at all referring to rejoicing when Rishayim get destroyed, because there is in fact another Pasuk that says you are supposed to rejoice, Be'ibud Rishayim. When Rishayim are destroyed, Rina, there is joyous singing. This is referring to kind of people against whom you have a personal grievance. Maybe it's a business competitor or something. In other words, it might be referring to the notion that don't rejoice when somebody is your competitor, you know, gets out of business and the like. But given the fact that Chazal do apply it even to Rishayim, Mitzrayim, the implication is that even that there's a simultaneous joy and sadness at the same time. There is a joy that a certain evil has been removed from the world, and that is a joy, but one does not get a personal satisfaction in the suffering of another human being, even a Rasha. So you have to split the idea that Baruch Hashem, the Rishus, has been eliminated from the world, but not that you want the Rasha to suffer, because the attitude is that you want a person to do tshuva. That would have been preferable. And I think we have to remember as well that there is a tragedy for the Ribbono Shel Olam himself when a soul does not reach its potential. Because every soul came into the world in the image of Hashem. And consequently, it's as if you had a child, and that child became a mass murderer. God forbid. So the child perhaps has to be killed, has to be taken out of commission. But how do the parents feel? And HaKadosh Baruch Hu infinitely feels even a greater sadness, in an infinite way, for the loss of the goodness that could have existed even within the person who eventually became a tremendous Rasha. That is why the Gemara says, the Chumash tells us that when somebody is executed by a Beis Din, so he is hung up, right, so people should see, and then he is taken down right away. You don't leave him overnight. The Gemara actually said you take him down immediately. And the Pasuk has a lashon, ki kilalas Elokim talui. A hung person is a curse to God, a reproach to God. And the Gemara takes the word kilala, meaning curse, but it also refers to a heaviness, meaning kaviyachol. It's very anthropomorphic. It puts these words in God's mouth. My head is very heavy with grief that one of my children is hanging, even though it's the one who committed all of these horrendous averos and the like. So there is the simultaneous idea of joy upon the destruction of evil, but once again, not getting any personal satisfaction. Golda Meir once said, again, it's a controversial quote, and many people don't like it, so I'm not endorsing the whole thing. But she once said, we can forgive the Arabs for killing our children. That's the one that people hate, you know, who says, but we cannot forgive the Arabs for making us kill their children. So the first part of the statement I will disassociate myself from, but the second part of the statement has some truth, that mitzidenu, it is a tragedy that we have to kill. Now, on one hand, God is not a pacifist. You know, in spite of God telling the angels, don't sing to me now, Hashem did kill the Egyptians. Hashem didn't say, turn the other cheek. Hashem didn't say, let them continue what they're doing. So HaKadosh Baruch Hu, you know, takes the revenge that is necessary to get rid of Rishayim in the world, eventually. But it's not done with joy. You know, there was a picture in the newspapers around a few years ago, after one of these terrorist attacks, where they had an Arab guy, or a Palestinian terrorist, his hands were dipped in the blood of his victims. And he was dancing around with blood dripping off his hands. This would be inconceivable, unless a Jewish person was literally very, very mentally ill. It's not conceivable that a Jewish soldier who kills the enemies of Israel, properly so, would ever have a sense of this type of joy. Thank God I killed him and I'm dancing in his blood. That's such a bizarre idea. In fact, we know that even the prohibitions of the Torah regarding eating blood, drinking blood, all of that is connected to the idea that in the ancient world, you know, kind of taking in blood, you know, either gave you courage or made you more bloodthirsty. You know, it was enhanced the qualities of a warrior. And the Torah wants to be marchik, those qualities, from a Jewish person. So yeah, we fight. Habala hargecha, somebody who kills you, hashkein v'hareglo, go and kill them first. But there's not this sense of joy in it. So it's not a contradiction to say, v'ibad rishoyim rina, there is joy in the downfall of the wicked. But at the same time, we have bin fola yevecha al tisvach. Okay. I don't remember, I'm sorry if I'm repeating. Did I mention Rav Cook's word? I don't know if anyone remembers. If you don't remember, I'll say it again. If you do remember, the word of Rav Cook, Anu Malshinim al tihi sikva. Okay, I'll say it. I don't remember. But if nobody remembers, I can say it again. But if you do remember as I'm saying it, forgive me for repeating it. There's a beautiful word from Rav Kook. The Gemara says Shemona Esrei was originally 18 blessings. I said it? Okay. Should I say it? Okay, Shemona Katan? Okay, all right. Did I say it again? I'll say it quickly again for those who may not have heard it. That Shemona Esrei was originally 18 blessings, and Rabbi Gamliel needed to add a blessing against the heretics and the missionaries and the informers and everybody else, and he didn't know who would be the person who could write such a bracha. So he said, "Mi isakein lanu, who can make for us a bracha against the minim, against the heretics?" And he finally found Shmuel HaKatan, Shmuel the Humble, this is, and Shmuel the Humble wrote the bracha L'malchini malti sikva. So Rav Kook would explain, what is the big chiddush? What is so difficult about writing Berchas Aminim? It's a bracha against the heretics. So anybody could write, not anybody, but you know, there were many, many chachamim. Why couldn't Rabbi Gamliel write? So Rav Kook explained that Berchas Aminim is the only bracha in the Amida that is totally focused on cursing. It is not asking Hashem to give us something good. It is asking Hashem to punish, to destroy. So Rabbi Gamliel's point is this. When you ask Hashem to destroy evil, your motives cannot be vengeance, they cannot be hatred, they cannot be anger, they cannot be a desire to have somebody else suffer. It has to be totally for the purpose of bringing goodness into the world and goodness into Klal Yisrael. So Rabbi Gamliel says, who among us is capable of that kavana? If we were to make a bracha against the Nazis, who could not have that sense of personal hate and animosity, wanting them to suffer and the like? But that taints the bracha, because that makes the bracha a source of hate and a source of revenge. So who is the only person who could have totally disinterested kavanas only l'shem shemayim? This is Shmuel HaKatan, because Pirkei Avos tells us that Shmuel HaKatan's motto was b'nefala yevecha al tismach. It says in Pirkei Avos, hu haya omer, this pasuk, therefore he is capable of writing the Birchas Aminim. And even if it's true that our own individual kavana might be tainted, but it's kind of the bracha gets its meaning based on the original intention that was put in, even if our kavanas are not always going to be that perfect. Yeah.
We see by the case of Rav Meir and his wife Bruya that he was going to curse them out. She said, "Pray that they do tshuva." So the kasha that came to me is, what about over here? But that's different than the ones who were troubling Rav Meir. These people are destroying Hashem in the world, the meaning. Right. So in other words, he could have made a prayer, let the meaning do tshuva.
Yeah.
But he didn't have it because they're so bad that to take away from Hashem's honor, the meaning. That may
right.
be,
they're already right.
Did you not get upon that meaning?
It's a good point. I mean, people do ask the kasha, why in the Brichas Aminim don't we have a prayer that they should do tshuva? Some want to say, it's a little bit of a dochek, but some want to fetch into it by saying, well, you destroy the minim because they're not minim anymore because they do tshuva. But that's not the mashmos of the bracha. The bracha implies, get rid of them. At some point, the damage is so great that you have to get rid of them. Now, who they are, as I say, is still, we're not entirely clear exactly who were the people that this bracha was masukin against. Some say it was the early Christians that were infiltrating. Actually, they were Jews, and they were trying to infiltrate and propagate the teachings of Christianity within the base Knessets. In fact, this explains a lot of things. You know, the Mishnah in Megillah has a lot of strange rules that you really wouldn't know. You really don't know what it's talking about. It talks about if a chazan, refuses to daven for the Amud unless he's dressed in white, you don't let him daven for the Amud. All sorts of different rules and conditions that people would make. Essentially, a lot of this was referring to the customs of early Jewish Christians, what they would insist upon, and this was kind of an identifying mark that these were people. Later years, when Christianity began, in fact, there's even a theory. Okay, this is really a little bit of tirichol here, but I'll tell you, there's a theory that's been discredited. I don't think anyone takes it totally seriously, but there is a theory that the inventor of Christianity is Paul. Now, Paul lived after Yeshua. But Paul was the one who separated Christianity from Judaism, that you don't have to keep kosher, you don't have to keep bris milah anymore. This was a big machlokas, Peter and Paul. Peter held a follower of Yeshua should still have a bris and keep the Shabbos and keep kashrus. And Paul was machadesh, the New Testament, the abrogation of the covenant. This was Paul's chiddush. So there was a historical theory that Paul was actually a shaliach of the Sanhedrin. Because Christianity, when it was working within a Jewish framework, was very, very dangerous. Because Jews would be nimshach after it, thinking they could be good Jews and believe in Yeshua. So Paul was given a shlichus by the Sanhedrin to separate, make Christianity a separate religion. Again, it's an interesting theory. I say most historians don't agree with it so much.
Who says it, by the way? Do you remember?
I think this was Chaim Maccabi, who's a historian. Maccabi, is that how pronounce it?
He's very strong. With Yiddish, trying to separate the two.
Yeah. Now there is another teaching which has a makor in Rishonim already. In Rishonim, that say that Peter, whose name was Shimon. Peter means rock, so he's called Shimon Kippa. Simon Kippa is rock in Aramaic. Shimon Kippa means Simon the rock, which is Peter. Simon Peter is the author, did you ever hear this? Is the author of the prayer Nishmas. Nishmas is the, what we say every Shabbos, beautiful prayer of Nishmas. And he is the author of Nishmas, and in fact he was a Baal Shuvah, and they have all story that the And this is brought in some Rishonim. Some Rishonim actually bring this, and they bring this in the name of a medrash that we don't have as a medrash. So that's very, very mesubach. But there actually is such a teaching. As they say, a lot of these things are very murky. We really don't know. Why did I mention? The Malshinim. Okay.
I believe it was in the year 80 that Rabbi Gamliel threw them out of the shul of the Beit HaKnesset, the Christians, when they came in, so they wouldn't merge in with the...
You have to realize it really was in the first decades of Christianity. it was not operating as a separate type of religion at all. It was within Judaism. And there was a very, very great danger. Many Jews in Nimshach. Today, it's come back again with the Jews for Yashka and other things. Sometimes you'll have people with, you know, they look Haredi. You know, they wear tzitzis out and beards and payas and everything. And they're followers of Yashka. I remember in my youth, there was a missionary gathering in Baltimore. Not in my youth, I mean, I was a teenager. So a bunch of yeshiva guys, I was one of them, we were supposed to infiltrate the rally. This is something I can't imagine I even do this, but it's so out of character, but infiltrate the rally and go over to individual people who look Jewish and kind of, not, you know, not to yell or anything, but just talk to them, like, you know, like Chabad does, go over, are you Jewish, etc., and give them stuff. So I remember my thing that I went to a few people, most of them weren't interested. I finally got a guy with a beard, and he was, like, so interested. He wanted to hear everything I had to say, and I was, you know, saying everything I had to say. And I was very proud of myself. Oh, it's a very, you know, did a lot of good work. It turned out this guy was the head of the Jews for Yashka, and he wanted to hear like all of the arguments so he could prepare, you know, whatever it is. So it was not that successful. So that was the end of my activism. But it really is Mesis Umeidiach Mamish. Mesis Umeidiach Mamish. And particularly when you have people like Russian Jews who just don't know and they hear something. And there's also a Musar that's involved because the Jews for Yashka are very, very friendly and very, very welcoming. And Baba Niseinu HaRabim, sometimes it happened to be that they were more friendly and more welcoming than some of the regular Orthodox Jews. And again, it's a muster that we have to take. That's if the Ayve Hashem are so friendly and welcoming, we have to counteract it. And that's why people gravitated to them. Yeah.
My experience is that they might be friendly and welcoming until you start asking questions.
Yeah, yeah. Well, of course. I mean, listen. They're praying. They're praying. P-R-E-Y-I-N-G. Obviously, you have people who are totally ignorant. So the ignorant people will tend, you know, not. They're ainu yode alisho.
Right.
They don't know enough to ask any questions. So, you know, they'll just take whatever they take. I mean, they'll quote this verse in Isaiah and this verse in Daniel. And this, yeah, yeah. The people they're talking never heard it. Never heard of them. So they'll just, you know, take what they take.
There's also the danger, and I just want to point this out, because I went to Yad Lachim,
yeah.
And they do counter missionary, and they told about someone. And they said, this person is good, it's very good. The woman who was running a gayer school, and what happened was that she would report any gayer who believed that Yashka was a god, but she herself believed Yashka was Mashiach. So she let everyone in as Yashka's Mashiach, but not a god. And there's this, yeah. And they, you know, they have this thing, and a lot of these people are having that belief. That in the Jews composed the article to the editor by Rabbi Shalom Gold, Neri Yisrael Muslim from Har Nov.
Right.
He said at one time when they had 500 of these people in Israel. Now he said they have 20,000.
Yep.
They have synagogues that look like a synagogue, and then at the end they mention Yeshua Mashiach. And I was once taken, and I went for a place for Shabbos just outside Yerushalayim, and in the middle of this mirror they put Yashka into this mirror.
Really?
Yeah, and I was fooled by this guy.
I mean, you were there, and you were there for Shul Davening.
Yeah, I came for Shabbos with my son there.
Yeah.
In the middle of this mirror, so the main Olam Haba.
Oh yeah.
They're very tricky.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah. So just shows you. Anybody can be fooled. Anybody can be trapped. And,
The one who didn't do is, you see, it's not a rav who's even a learned rav in Shas and Poskim cannot really understand them. I hate to say this. It required like Rav Bullman, who hashkafa, or Rav Breider,
right.
With you have to have hashkafa of Musar and Hasidus to go right into the thing. But
and you have to know Tanakh also.
Yeah.
That's the problem. You have to know Tanakh. That's your, I think Rabbi Lazarus in Or Lagola gives a course. He actually gives it in Derech too, I think. In like how to combat, how to address missionary ideas. You know, he goes through. I guess it's really, it's a question. You know, they have like whatever it is. They have 10 biblical verses that they cite, and you know, a lot of it yeshiva guys have never even learned. Even been yeshiva many years. You know, Yeshayo, and just to go over how we understand them, what the Rishonim say, what Chazal say. So when they say when there's a verse in Isaiah that the Alma which they translate, the virgin will give birth. Well, Alma's not a virgin. Basula's a virgin. A lot of it is simple mistranslation, often deliberate, sometimes ignorant, whatever the reason is. But if you just know the translations of the words, so and the context, you're able to address a lot of the so-called proofs that people bring. Okay, some of the proofs are in the nature. You know, there's an old joke. They say this joke is so old, but I heard it when I was in fifth grade. But although I heard Roy Pinder say it recently, but the joke is, you know, what is the proof that you have to wear a yarmulke when you go outside?
Would Avraham Avinu go out without a yarmulke?
Well, it says, Yaakov, Yaakov left Beersheba. You know, would Yaakov leave without a yarmulke? Certainly, you know, it's a proof. So some of their proofs are very similar to that, that type of thing. Okay. Alrighty. So now let's go down a little bit. Go down to Pasuk Chaf Gimel. Pasuk Chaf Gimel is Gam Eile L'Chachamim. So this is actually, remember, the Gra explained that Mishlei is made up of several collections of proverbs, not all of which are by Shlomo HaMelech. This reminds you of the major divisions in the book. The beginning of the book, the beginning of the Sefer, starts off, it's called Mishlei Shlomo ben David Melech Yisrael, right? The Proverbs of Shlomo ben David Melech Yisrael, and that goes for 9 prakim. So now look at beginning of Perek Yud. Perek Yud is a new collection. Now Perek Yud is the largest part of the book. Perek Yud also begins Mishlei Shlomo. And just to remind you, the difference between the first 9 parakim and the part beginning in Perek Yud is the first 9 parakim are longer, general Musar Shmuzim, so to speak. And once we get into Perek Yud, it's very staccato and very short, and each pasuk is a new idea. Now, Perek Yud extends all the way, in fact, we're in the last chapter of part 2, all the way until Perek Chafei. You'll notice Perek Chafei, the next chapter, begins Gam Eile Mishlei Shlomo Asher Hetiku Anshe Chizkiya Melech Yehuda. Now this is very interesting because Chizkiya Melech Yehuda was a king who lived, he was a descendant of Shlomo, descendant of David. He lived around 100 years after Shlomo. But the Pasuk itself says that apparently there were various teachings of Shlomo that had not yet been in the book of whatever Mishlei was at that time, and this was added. Right. So far we have 3 different parts of Mishlei. We have Mishlei Shlomo ben David, which is Aleph to Tes, Mishlei Shlomo, which is Yud through Chaf Dalet. Then we have Mishlei Shlomo, which Chizkiyo added, which is Perek Chaf Hei. And then there's a 4th book, or maybe 5 books. Look at Perek Lamed. Now Perek Lamed, again this is by way of review, we went over this a very long time ago, but Perek Lamed introduces another person. Divrei Agur bin Yokeh. Right, so this is book 4. The words of Agur bin Yokeh. Now, who on earth is Agur bin Yokeh? Rashi says this is a pseudonym. This is a made-up name for Shlomo, and it comes from the following etymology. Agur means to gather. La'agur is a synonym for gathering. Bin, no, it doesn't say ben, right? It says bin. So bin means understanding. And Yokeh means regurgitate or vomit. So basically it says he gathered wisdom, he understood it, and then he communicated, regurgitated. Agur bin Yokeh. Rashi does not explain why would he not be referred to by this name until the very end of the... I mean, if this is a name, then use it all the time. The Vilna Gaon gives something that's more modern interpretation. And he simply says, Agur bin Yokeh bin, he doesn't say bin is the same as ben, he does not give any significance to that, is the name of an otherwise unknown, very wise person, whose proverbs were also considered to be said with Ruach HaKodesh, and therefore, just like Sefer Tehillim. Right, Sefer Tehillim, we say, was written by David, and yet in Sefer Tehillim, we have Tefillah LeMoshe. We have 11 authors of Sefer Tehillim, meaning Sefer Tehillim never meant that David HaMelech wrote every single thing. He was the primary author, and then there were other things that Chazal put in that, of course, everything was Ruach HaKodesh, otherwise it wouldn't have made the Ksuvim, but they were written with Ruach HaKodesh. Mishlei too, there are other authors. Agur bin Yarkeh, according to the Gra, is another author. And then finally, Perek Lamed Aleph introduces an otherwise unknown person, Lemuel. This is Lemuel. Lemuel. And in fact, the most famous part of Mishlei, which is the very end, Eishes Chayil, a woman of valor, is not Shlomo's work, it is Lemuel's work. Unless Lemuel's also Shlomo, which is what Rashi says. So according to the Vilna Gaon, we actually have five collections in Mishlei. Three collections of Shlomo HaMelech, one of Agur bin Yarkeh, and one of Lemuel. However, other Mefarshim say that within the single largest collection, the largest collection we've been learning for quite a long time, that starts from Perek Yud to the end of Perek Chavtalu. That's a big, that's certainly 75% of the book of Mishlei. But even within that larger unit, we can identify smaller collections. So let me show you two more divisions within the larger one. Yeah. Look first in Perek Chaf Beis. Pasuk Yud Zayin. So in the middle it just says, Hat Aznecha, incline your ear, Ushma Divrei Chachamim, listen to the words of the Chachamim. So the Gra doesn't learn this way, but some of Farshim learn this is a new collection, a shorter collection of proverbs of assorted Chachamim, who are not given a name. And it goes on, Halo Kesafti Lecha, if you look at Pasuk Chaf, Halo Kesafti Lecha Shalishim. So Shalishim is translated, I have written down for you, Shalishim, noble sayings, but some read it Shaloshim, 30 proverbs. And they actually count 30 proverbs from this point, which is a small collection within. And by the same token, in the Perek we're learning now, Pasuk Chaf Gimel, Gam Eila L'Chachamim. These two are sayings of the wise, right? So these are like two smaller collections within the larger collections. According to that, you can have as many as seven collections of proverbs in the book of Mishlei. So some say this is the beginning of a new little set until the end of the Perek. And that is, Gam Eila L'Chachamim. These two are the words of the Chachamim, Haker Panim Bamishpat, Baal Tov. Now, Haker Panim Bamishpat, this is really a phrase that appears in the Torah. The Torah says, Lo Sakiru Panim Bamishpat. What does that mean? Do not recognize faces in judgment. That means do not show favoritism. Now, the obvious question is, I don't need the book of Mishlei to simply tell me don't violate a prohibition in the Torah. So what are you telling me? Recognizing, showing favoritism in judgment is not good. Well, of course it's not good. The Torah has a negative commandment. Lo sakiru panim bar mishpat. So the Gra explains that Baal Tov is not simply saying it is not good to show favoritism in judgment, that's obvious. But it means showing favoritism in judgment is not good for the whole world, meaning it's a cosmic point. He's referring to the fact that ivus hadin, perversion of justice, dishonesty of justice, brings tragedies and sadness and punishment and midas hadin in the world. And that's what he says. He says he brings a Gemara in Maseches Saita, Misherabu makire panim bamishpat.
What is the
pasuk? Huh? The pasuk we're learning is Perek Chafdalit, pasuk Chafgimel. Hakir panim bamishpat bal tov. Bal means not good. So he quotes a Gemara in Saita that Mamish makes this point exactly. Misherabu makire panim bamishpat. When people who were makir panim bamishpat became many, batla ol malchus shamayim. The yoke of the kingdom of heaven became nullified. People threw over. They had no longer any fear for God. Okay, what's so bad about that? V'nitein aleihem ol malchei umos ha'olam. You're always going to have a yoke on you. If you throw off the yoke of heaven, you will get the yoke of the umos ha'olam that will be much, much harder on you. And therefore, that's what the pasuk is saying. The goodness, the freedom, the simcha, the joy of your life, whatever it is, the ability of the Jewish people to flourish, that will be diminished when there is what is called hakaras panim. Now, let me point out that Rashi explains from the Gemara that the issur of hakaras panim isn't just referring to perverting the judgment, meaning I decide in your favor even though you shouldn't win. But even if I just treat, if a judge or a beis din treats one litigant with more respect, again, it's an interesting thing. How a beis din is supposed to behave. Let's say sometimes you have a big Talmud Chacham is either suing, although that's less common, but sometimes Talmud Chacham will be suing someone who's not Maaretz, but usually it'll be the other way. Usually Talmud Chacham tend not to sue that much, but a Maaretz might be suing a big Talmud Chacham. And what is the beis din supposed to do? Let's say you're on a beis din. And like, you know, a big suit. Now, we're not talking about it's your Rebbe. You wouldn't be allowed to be in a beis din and your Rebbe. But let's say it's just a big Talmud Chacham, but you have no connection with them. Well, you're supposed to show the person kavod. On the other hand, you know, you're not supposed to show any type of favoritism to one litigant over another litigant. So you have to treat both of them the same. And the reason that's so is Rashi says that when the other side sees, even if you're going to try to judge fairly, but if the other side sees that you're treating the other person so much better, they're going to become intimidated. They're going to become tongue-tied. They're not going to be able to present their case because they feel they've already lost it. Right? So that is nichlal in lo sakiru panim bamishpat. And what the pasuk in Mishlei is adding is that this does not just constitute an avera, but this brings evil into the world. Now, look in the Shemoneh Esrei where you see the exact same point. In the Shemoneh Esrei, every day, the weekday Shemoneh Esrei, Hashiva Shofteinu Kvarishona, give us back the judges that we had, meaning judges that are honest and learned, right? And by the restoration of a justice system, you will take away from us sadness and groaning. Because when the justice system is not working properly, that brings sadness into the world, and that brings oppression into the world, right? So that's exactly what this pasuk is saying.
Is there proof to what you said? About this is what, if this was in the Torah, why is it here? Because this is a rod that is, it will spread out for the whole thing.
Yes.
The next pasuk where it mentions Amin, I don't know the Hebrew too well.
Right.
But that reflect the proof for it. The next pasuk where it It's because it's smichus of sukkah.
Yes, no, no, yeah, the psukim are connected, right? They're right.
That's right.
The next pasuk is concluding. Omer l'rasha tzadik ata. And this refers to either an individual or a court. When you tell the Rasha, oh, you're a righteous person, you're good, what's going to happen is yekvua amim, the nations of the world are going to curse you, meaning ra will happen to you from the different Am Yisrael, from the nations of the world, yizamu l'umim, they will relate angrily to us.
I'm just not sure if, is this only referring to Jewish people, or is this judgment even to non-Jewish people? Because, like, let's say, you know, in other places, you know, non-Jews, do they have to apply by this, or they do not?
Yeah, I think they would, because remember that non-Jews are bound by the seven Noahide laws, and the seventh Noahide law is an obligation to establish court systems that administer justice impartially. So if a non-Jewish judge or a non-Jewish judicial system is not administering justice fairly, that is a perversion and a violation of a universal law, which will bring wrath into the world. That's 100% correct. So this is not uniquely a Jewish obligation. The Chassam Sofer says, because of this, there's an interesting shaila the Chassam Sofer has. A Jew was held in jail. This was the shaila. I guess it's fascinating. It's not an easy shaila. A Jew was arrested in Europe, and he was sentenced to death. And there was a way that the community could get him out if they would bribe the jailers. In other words, they couldn't get him out legally, but they could get him out illegally by bribery. So the Chassam Sofer discusses, are we allowed to bribe either judges or officials to save a Jew's life? So the Chassam Sofer makes two points in opposite ways. The first point he makes is, as a general rule, it is forbidden for a Jew to bribe a judge, either a Jewish judge or a non-Jewish judge. Because when you bribe a judge, you are causing the judge to pervert justice, and that is prohibited under the 613 mitzvahs. And it is forbidden under the Noahide law, and for you to cause a non-Jewish judge to sin is lifneiver. Right? You cannot, lifneiver, you're not allowed to cause a non-Jew to violate the Noahide laws. So that's point number one. But then the Chassam Sofer says a surprising point. But he says, in this case it would be mutter, because he said, a non-Jewish court does not have halachic authority to sentence a Jewish person to death. Because a Jewish person can only be sentenced by a Sanhedrin of 23 judges, Jewish judges, in accordance with witnesses, in accordance with warning. So by definition, the Chassam Sofer says, any capital punishment imposed by a non-Jewish court on a Jew is a halachically illegal sentence. So when you bribe the system to let the Jew go, you are not bribing
He's
to have justice.
Illegal.
That's correct. You're not bribing to create an injustice, but it is to prevent an injustice. Now on one hand, maybe that sounds pashut, but that's far from clear. Meaning, some learn that if B'nai Nayach were given the koach to establish a court system, they have that koach even against Jewish inhabitants. See, the Chassam Sofer seems to say that the ability of non-Jewish courts to punish people only gives them that ability towards non-Jews, and doesn't give them that ability towards Jews. That's what the Chassam Sofer seems to be saying. If you look at Rashi and Gittin and Daf Tes, Rashi and Gittin seems to say the opposite. Rashi and Gittin seems to say that B'nai Nayach that are commanded on Dinim, that gives them authority even over Jewish citizens. That's a very interesting question. It has a lot of repercussions. For example, are you allowed to be a secular judge if you might send Jews to jail? can you work for the IRS to do tax auditing if Jews might be in jail? Can you be on a jury? Can you be a prosecutor? According to the Chassam Sofer, it's not clear that you could be, because according to the Chassam Sofer, all of those things that non-Jewish courts are doing to Jews are against halacha. But there are many, many other poskim there that do consider it legitimate. So if it's nogel u'maisa for anybody, should ask a rabbi about the choice of occupation and the like.
Oh, but in this case, so why don't you bring the case of like pikuach nefesh? I mean, wouldn't that override?
So here is the thing. I understand, but here is the thing. If under the laws of Ben, I mean, let's take a basin of Israel. If somebody's chayav misa, let's say it's a regular basin, the guy was sentenced to death. If I could get him out by bribing, pikuach nefesh is not going to matter. He's chayav misa. When you're chayav misa, there's no heter of pikuach nefesh. So the question becomes, if he was sentenced by a Noahide court, is that a Torah deka chayav misa? See, pikuach nefesh does not work when a person is halachically, legally, sentenced to death. You see? I mean, just like you wouldn't say, I could bribe to get a guy that was sentenced to death by a beis din because of pikuach nefesh. He's chayav misa. So that's the question. Okay.
So,
yeah.
Let me stand up to the suggestion with, if you believe that by being this auditor or the judge, someone's going to do it ultimately, and whoever's doing it is going to send the yid to jail. If you believe that you're the person who's taking responsibility for dealing with the matter, you can deal with it in a more, like mentioned, type of way, and more according to halacha than someone else who maybe is a goy or
that might be it might
could
be
that a hetzer to do it?
It might there is a hetzer to do it. I'm not telling you it's
right,
something.
Right.
But like the Chassam Sofer is much more problematical. But you might say that you could be more Rachmanis or less anti-Semitic or whatever it would be. Ramesh Lamaisa has a tshuva that permits it. Ramesh actually does permit it. Although he says it's not the best job for a nice Jewish boy, meaning you shouldn't choose jobs that put you in that position, but if you have such a job, you are permitted and obligated, not just permitted, to fulfill the job to the best of your ability and the like. Okay. All right, so that's the Hakir Panim B'Mishpat. Now then, it's contrasting, right? Because Pasuk Chaf Dalet talks about the flatterer, the hypocrite, the one that says to the Rasha, you're great. So what Shlomo HaMelech is saying is, ultimately, even the Rishayim themselves will see through your flattery and despise you. No, traitors generally are not admired even by the countries to which they go to and the like, because they see they have no loyalty. So the person who starts praising the Russia is eventually going to be despised even by the Russia. But Pasuk Chafei says, V'la mochichim, but those who honestly give Musar, mochichim, those who have the courage to speak up when there is evil, yin am, there will be pleasantness. V'aleihem tavo birkas tov, and upon them there shall be the blessing of goodness. Now again, in Mishlei, we can never say that every pasuk is universally true, because that's why there are contradictory pasukim here. We did have pesukim in Mishlei that say sometimes it's better to keep quiet and don't give muzer. But this is expressing an idea that will sometimes apply, sometimes not. But the idea is that people respect honesty and adherence to principle. If you're a person that's wishy-washy, you're a person that switches, you're a person that's always, I'm okay, you're okay, you don't stand for anything, then eventually, even the people that you're always making concessions to are not going to respect you. But when you're willing to say, this is the emes, even though it seems very hard to stand up against the misnagdim themselves will have a grudging respect for you at some point. You know, I have a story from, I knew a family in Maryland. So this is a very, very interesting. The family was what you call conservative. They were not totally Shomer Shabbos. They were traditional. But they would drive on Shabbos to go to Shul or whatever it is. Whenever it was too far to a bar mitzvah or whatever it is. So there were two, and the father was a bit of an overbearing person. He kind of demanded. So they had a daughter. Baruch Hashem, the daughter's not married with children, but they had a daughter who became like a very strict Shomeres Shabbos from age 10. She just became frum. And she just refused to go into the car. She just refused. So she once told me a story that there was some bar mitzvah that they had to go to, and her father insisted they go in the car. And the daughter said, I'm not going. I'm going to walk. I'm going to walk 5 miles. And the mother said, well, I'm going to walk with her. I don't want to drive either. So the father said, he was a demanding guy, he said, you stay in the car. Because since there are times you went into the car, you don't really hold to it, you know, you're not that strong. You, in other words, he was basically saying that you're wishy-washy, I don't respect, all of a sudden you're becoming frum on me. But she, you know, has the right to walk, and I'll drive the car slowly. In other words, that was the kind of idea that he actually respected the fact that his daughter did not compromise. No matter how hard it was, she stood by the emes. So that's kind of the mussar here, that we sometimes think, but again, you have to know, because sometimes you have to be, obviously you have to be soft and you have to express it in a menschlich way, but we sometimes think that standing up for the emes won't be accepted, it won't be appreciated, it'll just be a source of conflict. Doesn't have to be that way. If a person truly, truly, truly has principles of his life that are firm and non-negotiable, the other side will respect it. It'll respect it. That is why, you know, people often say, in the university world, people often say that the easiest colleges to work with are Catholic colleges. Because, you know, if you have religious needs and you basically say, I can't do this on Yom Tov and Chol HaMoed and all these different holidays, especially the beginning of a semester in the secular college, September, you know, is a very, very difficult time. We have Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, and Sukkot and everything else. Like half of the first 3 weeks of college, you know, are going to be gone in different ways. So people say that they always find that the Catholic schools are very willing to accommodate them, but the Jewish professors are the most difficult. They're the most difficult because if they're not frum. So who are you? You're telling me you have Jewish holidays? Well, you know, I have Rosh Hashanah. I don't have the other stuff or whatever it is. But the Catholic, you know, once again, they believe in religion, even though it's not the same religion, and therefore they can respect a person of commitments, and the like. So that is the idea that mochichim yinam, that those who give tochacha in an honest and conscientious way, on them, even their enemies may bless them. Even the people that you are criticizing may bless you. And again, the pasuk says, "Fasayim yishak," lips will kiss a person who says good, true wisdom. Okay. Let's go a little further. I may have to stop soon, unfortunately. One second. Pasuk Chaf Zayin. Again, these are short pesukim. Hachein b'chutz melachtecha v'yateta v'asadeh lach achar ubanisa beisecha. So here the Gra gives two pshatim. One pshat is based on a teaching that Chazal say in Maseches Saita, that what is the order, what should a person do before they get married, maybe Nagel and Maisa, for a lot of people. Now the Gemara in Saita darshans it based on the sequence of people who go to war or people who don't go to war, right? It talks about certain people are excused from going to war. Now these are optional wars of expansion. These are not milchamas of defense. So it mentions the person who built a house and has not yet lived in it, a person who planted a vineyard but did not yet enjoy the fruit because for the first 3 years it is orla, And the third category is the person who betrothed a woman, erisin, but did not yet consummate the marriage. They are sent home. Again, if it's a milchemes mitzvah, they fight, but a milchemes rishus, they are sent home. So the Gemara looks at the sequence. House, vineyard, wife. And it says that that is the sequence of what a person should have. Although it puts vineyard before house, that's a kasha. But it basically says, before a person gets married, he should have a home to which he could bring his wife. Now, obviously, since most of the time people look for a home together, but at least he should have the wherewithal, the financial capacity to supply a home or an apartment, something. And he should have a kerem, a vineyard, which means a parnasa of some sort. Kerem. Okay, that one needs, because once again, there's a chiyuv in the ksuva that a husband is supposed to support his wife. Now, granted, there's a whole discussion today with Kollel, where often it's the wife who supports the husband, and some say the need for her Harbatzas Torah is so great that we...
She wants it.
One has to want it. And that is why a husband must be eternally grateful. It is not something the husband is entitled to. It is a gift that his wife is giving him for the benefit of the whole family. But it is never a taina, you know, she has to do this. At any time, she could say, you have a chiyuv under the ksuva to support me. So the Gra says that these steps are merumas in this pasuk as well. Hachein b'chutz melachtecha. Prepare your work, your income from the outside, meaning the Gra says pragmatia, some type of business. V'yatata basodeh. And your sheep in the field, meaning it's either or, meaning either you have business or you have farm agriculture. And then, achar, after you have the income to support a family, ubanisa beisecha, you can build your home. And we know, of course, a home is a wife, like beisozu ishto, meaning one should not get, right, the simple meaning is one should not get married until you have some economic plan to be able to support a wife. Now he then brings a drash that prepare outside your work. This is a reference to mikra. This is a reference to learning the Torah shebichsav. That is called chutz. That is the Torah that's outside. Because without the Torah Shebaal Peh, I really don't understand it. I need to know the Chumash, because that's the foundation. But it's really outside of me, because it doesn't penetrate my full understanding without the oral law. But prepare that outside, which is Mikra. And then, Izita Basadelach, the produce of the field is the Torah Shebaal Peh, because that grows... Right, that grows, that expands. You plant, just like you plant the seed and things keep on growing, the Torah Shebaal Peh grows and deepens your understanding, and then you build your home, that is the sodos of the Torah. Right, the Gra talks about the secrets of the Torah, the Kabbalah, the mystical ideas of the Torah. Right, so what is the Pasuk telling me? Just like marriage has a certain progression, so too, Torah learning has a certain progression. Now, there's a big interest. Everyone likes to learn Kabbalah right away. We read mysticism. What do they say? Mysticism is the big seller. What do they say? That somebody wanted to publish a book in English on the Chumash. So the publisher says, you know, we don't take any new books on Chumash because there are so many. It's very difficult. You know, if you were to write a book on the Chumash, it would be difficult to publish because there are so many books on Chumash that publishers say it's not going to sell. You're going to put your book. Says, so what sells? So they say anything with either Soloveitchik or Kabbalah. so it's either Soloveitchik or Kabbalah, that'll sell. But if it doesn't have one of those two things, you're not going to be able to sell. So I guess if you do
He changed the title of his book. Kabbalah of the Torah,
or Rav Soloveitchik and Kabbalah. Or maybe you can do it in tiny preaching. Rav Soloveitchik and Kabbalah, who put knots in small. that would do it, and the like. Okay. Let's do one more pasuk. Pasuk Chafei. But again, I want to point out, you know, the Gra actually says in the book of Mishlei, right, there's so many things here, it's hard to remember where, but he says in the book of Mishlei, and other places as well, that the Geula HaAsida will come in the merit of increased Torah learning, and he says, Bifrat, especially in the Sodos HaTorah. So the Vilna Gaon says that in order to bring Mashiach, there must be a greater learning of the mystical portions of the Torah, of Kabbalah. So there is a reason, even though it's misused by a lot of people, but there is a reason, Bahashkacha, why Kabbalah has spread to ever-widening circles. Now again, you have to be very careful. It's often distorted, or we're often not able to understand it, etc. Like anything else, HaKadosh Baruch Hu puts all sorts of good things in the world that we then misuse or misapply or distort and the like. But the notion of Panemius, called Panemius HaTorah, the inner dimension of Torah, is something that will happen. The spreading of Panemius HaTorah will occur before the coming of Mashiach. And that is why even within the yeshiva world, we find many great, you know, Balei Machshava that are fairly rooted in Kabbalah. For example, Moshe Shapiro. I don't know if you know Moshe Shapiro, but he used to teach in Or Sameach. Now he still gives a shir in Or Sameach to not really to Or Sameach people, but all over Yerushalayim, there are people who come here to hear him. But he's one of the great deep Balei Machshava, but much rooted in Kabbalah and there are others as well. This is part of the idea that before the coming of Mashiach, there will be his pashtus, there will be the spreading of Torah Sasod, of the secret ideas of the Torah. But, so on one hand, that has to happen and that's supposed to happen, and that's a good thing. That will bring us, prepare the world for Geula. On the other hand, the Gra says, side by side with the idea that Geula will only come with the learning of the Sodos of Kabbalah, the Gra repeats over and over again, and he was not the first one, that this has to be built on a foundation of the written Torah, the oral Torah, that one needs to be conversant with the whole Shas, actually, to really delve into the Kabbalah in a deep way, because otherwise the ideas are distorted and that can be very, very destructive in many, many ways unless one is grounded in it. So that's important, yeah.
When you say Kabbalah, do you mean, is it just specifically Zohar, or can people, like, because there's certain rules for learning that, but to learning stuff like Tanya, that's also under the rules of Kabbalah?
Yeah, so what Chassidus says, and again, I think it's largely accepted by everybody, is that what the Baal Shem Tov did was, the Baal Shem Tov took the teachings of Kabbalah, it's not only the Zohar, but also the Ari's writings, Eitz Chaim and the like, And he brought them down to earth in a more popularized, accessible way. So as a result, Chassidus is said to be a lima that everybody can do. And again, the truth matters, I think that that's largely accepted. Now, what particular Sfarim is, that's a matter of debate, but many people learn Tanya, many people learn Svasemes, many people learn Reb Sadak. All of these Sfarim are very much based on Kabbalah. But it's a more popularized type of Kabbalah in which what the Lubavitch Rebbe had a good description of it. He said, let's say, Tanya is to Kabbalah like medicine is to anatomy. Kabbalah is like the whole system, but it's very abstract. You're just looking at hundreds, if not thousands, of interlocking parts, but you don't know how it applies to healing the soul. So Chassidus tries to take the anatomy of the Ari and turn it into medicine, how it actually can work as a practical refuah sanefesh. So, but even Tanya, I mean, listen, maybe two-thirds of the Tanya is written in a relatively non-Kabbalistic way, but one-third is fairly heavy Kabbalah. Now, sometimes it's put into footnotes or this and that, but you know, there's a whole Kabbalistic vocabulary that if you're not familiar with, that you won't understand. But a lot of same thing about it. Not just that. I can say the same thing about the Nefesh HaChaim. Nefesh HaChaim is also presupposes a familiarity with the Kabbalah of the Arizal, but there's a lot that you can get that's not Kabbalistic. In fact, a lot of the Zohar is not Kabbalistic. It's very interesting. You know, you think the Zohar is the Sefer of Kabbalah, but around 40 to 50% of the Zohar is like learning Medrash. It's not based on any mystical or panemius. No, it's a hard Medrash. The language is very hard, etc. But it's not that much more difficult than learning a Medrash. So not everything in the Zohar is Sod or Kabbalah. There are non-Kabbalistic teachings. In fact, they've even published Svarim that are called Niglos HaZohar. Niglos HaZohar means the revealed portion of Torah that's in the Zohar that a person could read and elect. In the there's a wonderful it's almost like a Kahati on the Zohar. That's called Masuk Midvash. I don't know if you've seen it. It's like 20 volumes, Rev. Daniel Frisch, Zichrono Livracha. And he even has different typefaces, meaning to say, when it's something that's Nigla, it'll be in a certain print, and then when it's Nistaros, it's been a different print. So he actually says, if you're not conversant with Kabbalah, you can skip this part, but other parts you can still learn. So the truth of the matter is, one should even talk about the fact that, you know, well, maybe we can have a Shir in Zohar. I'm not going to volunteer. But I'm saying that there is much in the Zohar that is not technically Kabbalah. So Kabbalah and Zohar are not synonymous in that way.
He was holding those two parts of it as well.
Say again?
The
author did everything. The author did everything. But you know, as you're reading, when you get to a place that you don't know what's going on, so but it'll tell you, the typeface will also tell you. Same thing in the Grand Mishlei, right? The Grand Mishlei brings a lot of Kabbalah in, but not all the time, right? So Kabbalah is always here. The Ramban and Chumash brings it in. The Ramban and Chumash. In fact, the Ramban and Chumash was the first one who brought Kabbalah into mainstream interpretation. And whenever the Ramban would say Al derech ha'emes, that's his marker that I'm about to tell you something Kabbalistic. And he writes in his Hagdama that if you're not conversant and you have not received from a Rebbe about how to understand this, you should skip it. He demands that you skip it. You don't even read it. That's what he says. He puts it in and he says, do not read it if you haven't had a Rebbe for it. You know that Rebbe Yashiv's grandfather was a very, very famous, very, very famous Kabbalist, the Leshem. He wrote a sefer, Leshem Shavo V'Yachlema, which is the names of three precious jewels in the breastplate. And the sefer is still around. I mean, you can get the Leshem. It's a very heavy, heavy Kabbalistic sefer. So the Leshem was very, very close to his grandson, Rebbe Yashiv. He was very, very close. And Rebbe Yashiv actually helped him. Rebbe Yashiv copied. Leshem had his notebooks, but they were, you know, messy, whatever it is. Rebbe Yashiv would recopy them for publication. And in some of the Leshem, in some of the pages, you'll sometimes see a note that says, that a little note from little Rebbe Yashiv, who was 12 or 13, that he reorganized two sentences to make them run better or something. Whenever he made a little change, he would make a note. So already at 12, he was editing on some level heavy Kabbalistic work. So people used to try to always get from Rebbe. He actually never talked about himself. Really, he was very, very reticent. He didn't waste time on anything. So people were always trying to ask him, does he know Kabbalah? And he said, he doesn't do Kabbalah, he does Halacha. So somebody said, but you see, in the Leshem, you were 12 years old. So he said, enigmatically, he said, what I knew then is what I know now. It's not clear. It's not clear what that means.
Exactly. He didn't have the Yetzer HaTov at age 12.
Yeah, okay. But he was very, very close to the Leshem. So the Lechem was from, he came to Eretz Israel. He came to Eretz Israel, but most of his life he was in Lithuania. So what used to be is that Gedolim used to go to the Lechem for 6 months at a time for a crash course in Kabbalah. Like, they would take off 6 months and learn Kabbalah. The cook went to the Lechem, you know, when he was still in Europe. So they say Rav Isser Zalman went to the Lechem to kind of learn Kabbalah. And the Lechem said the first rule is you don't ask any questions for 6 weeks, because you just have to take in things for 6 weeks without asking any questions. So Rav Isser Zalman said he couldn't accept the terms. He couldn't. He said it wasn't shaykh for him to learn something without being able to ask a question. So he didn't take that course. But okay. All right, let's do one more pasuk. Al tihi eid chinam bereyacha v'hafitisa bisvasecha. Do not be a witness for naught against your friend, and to be enticed by your lips. So here again, the Gra gives two pshatim. The first pshat is quite literal. We know that the Torah says, in order for someone to be punished, there have to be two witnesses. So what is the halacha if I know that somebody did a very serious avera, and I go to Beis Din, and I report it to the Beis Din, but I'm the only one? So the halacha is, I committed a very serious sin, because since I don't have two witnesses to be able to get the guy punished, for me to simply come and tell the Beis Din, that is Lashon Hara. The Gra brings a story. There's a story about Zigud, a man called Zigud, went to Beis Din to testify that Tuvia was Mizana with a woman. So the Beis Din said, Zigud gets Malkus. This is Malkus Martis. This is not the Malkus of the Beis Din. But in other words, Beis Din had a harass Shah to give Malkus. So Zigud says, Tuvia chata v'zigud mingit? Tuvia commits a sin? And Zigud me? I get hit? And the answer is, yeah. Lashon Hara. Unless there's a positive purpose for you to come, it is Lashon Hara. And that is what it means. You have been enticed by your lips just to spread rumors about people. You're not allowed to do it. Now, that's not always the case. In certain matters in Eidach of disbelief, for example, and let me give you let's imagine somebody is a Rebbe in a yeshiva, and the Rebbe is hitting children or abusing children. So even though it's true that a Beis Din will not give Malkus unless there's two witnesses, but certainly one witness, if he's credible, is sufficient to either investigate or take a person off a job. So there are cases where one person is supposed to come forward. But if the only thing the Beis Din will do is either give the guy Malkus or not, if you're only one witness and they're not going to do it, then you're not supposed to go, because that is Lashon Hara. That is one explanation. Now, the Gra then gives a deeper explanation. And he says, there is something we do every single day, twice a day, that is called giving testimony. And that is, of course, reading the Shema. When you read the Shema, you are giving Eidos, that HaKadosh Baruch Hu is, that there's only one God, that He is the creator of heaven and earth, and my king. That is called Eidos. In fact, even in the Sefer Torah, Shema, the ayin of Shema is big, large, and Echad is large.
Dalet.
Ayin, Dalet. Eid. You're a witness. And for that, one witness is good. So what is an Eid Chinam? An Eid Chinam is a false witness. A witness for naught. And that is, when you say the words of Shema, you're not truly accepting Hashem as your king. So Al Tihi Eid Chinam is a warning. When you say the Shema, be sure you are not a false witness. Because if you don't believe it in your heart, then you are lying when you make that statement. Right? And therefore it's making the emphasis of being a truthful witness. Because otherwise, Vipitisa, you're trying to entice God. This is a very disrespectful thing to do. You're trying to entice God with your lips. Hey God, you know, do good things to me, but you don't really believe it. Right? But you fatua, you're trying to entice God with what you say without your heart. Now we know that for this is the reason, a similar reason is that it says you're not allowed to reach, that if you read Shema without tefillin on, you're giving false testimony, because you're saying ukashartim, you should tie the tefillin on your hand and on your head. You're not wearing tefillin. It's edus sheker biatzma. They say in the name of the Chassam Sofer, a very, very interesting halacha, that the Chassam Sofer says, now, at night, it's not edus sheker, because there's no mitzvah of tefillin at night. But the Chassam Sofer says the following ha'ara, and we're not knowing this way. He says, let's say you're davening Ma'ariv, and it's before Tzeis HaKechavim. You'll say Shema again, but you're davening Ma'ariv before Tzeis HaKechavim. The Chassam Sofer held you should wear tefillin.
Wow.
That's the Ritura.
Huh?
That's the Ritura, the Shema, because Bishok V'chol Vomecha is on the darkest and the Ritura.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, that's a good, that would be a good, yeah, that's a good point against the Chassam Sofer, that since you're not Yaitse Kriya Shema,
since you're not, it's actually Friday, yeah, because you don't have the Ois of Shabbos, and you're Makabel Shabbos, so now you have,
if you're Makabel Shabbos, right. So because of this, because the Chassam Sofer didn't want to do a minhag that people wouldn't accept or looked very strange, he never davened an early Ma'ariv, because he said he would be mechayev to put on tefillin. Yeah.
So what about in the morning if you wake up late?
Yeah. So here's the thing. So when you don't have a choice, here's the thing. If by waiting until you put on your tefillin, you're going to miss the Zman of Kriya Shema, so you have to prioritize. It is better to say Kriya Shema without tefillin, bizmana, than to be over on Kriya Shema and then wear tefillin, because you're not, then you've lost the whole mitzvah. So you have to prioritize, huh?
If it's in sheker, then it's a kiddush, then you should.
Yeah, but still, edus sheker is not.
It's ki'edus.
Yeah, it's not a deraisa edus sheker. It's not a deraisa edus sheker. So yeah.
That's why on a fast day like Tisha B'av, you would say the Shema with the tefillin on,
right,
even for minchas. You just with yotzei the Shema.
Right, that's correct. That's why for Tisha B'av, there really was a whole question. I mean, lamaisa our minhag is very definite that we don't wear tefillin in shacharis. Right, we don't put it on until mincha. But in the rishayim, that wasn't so pashut. There were many, many rishayim that were against that, and many rishayim took the position. The Gemara doesn't say that's the thing, that you should put on tefillin. I mean, for Kriya Shema, how can I say the Shema of the morning without tefillin? It's an Eidah Sheker. So you see that there are going to be occasions where we set Eidah Sheker aside for bigger reasons. Making Kriya Shema of his mind is a derisive reason, but even the Avelis of Tisha B'Av is also going to set aside the idea of
Eidah Sheker. Diarrhea. Can't wear tefillin, he wants to say the Shema, and we can say Shema.
That's right. That's another example. That's another example. But that's the union of the Eidus Sheker. And the last pasuk we'll read tonight is, so don't be an Eid Chinam, because then you are enticing God with your lips and not your heart. And pasuk Chavtes, Al tomar kasher asali keines elo, ashiv liyish kipa elo. Now this seems to be saying, don't engage in revenge. Do not say, as he did to me, so I will do to him. I will give him back what he gave me. So once again, Lefi Pshuto, if this is simply saying, don't take revenge, once again, that's in the Torah itself. We don't need a pasuk to simply tell me what is in the Torah. So the Gra says that the Ish could refer to Hashem. Hashem is also called Ish. It's like it says in Az Yashir, Hashem Ish Milchama. And this is the attitude of a person who basically says, hey, Hashem gave me my Yetzer Hara. Hashem gave me my taivus. Hashem gave me my weaknesses. I will give him back what he gave me. Meaning a person might have the attitude, I'm not responsible for the sins that I do. Hashem gave me the bad nature. So the pasuk is saying, don't say I'm going to give God back what he gave me. It's the other way around. Hashem gave us the struggle so we could exercise the koach of bechira. We don't turn back to God and say, hey God, you made me the way I am, therefore I'm not chayav. Right? That's how he learns that. It's going back on HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Okay, we'll stop here.
One point of information, I believe, with Noah, one egg is all that is needed.
That is correct.
This gentleman here wrote on the Taliban, they need four witnesses if to say that someone was in Sukkah's bailiff.
Oh yeah?
If three is not acceptable.
Reliable male witnesses.
Reliable, three from four, right?
Or really?
If three come forward,
they could be sued for charge of assignment.
So how come? That seems to be that it should be. I mean, I think the Taliban are killing more people than.
No, going to the he'll tell you. He thinks of them in a very different way. He's done a lot of research as a book, Torah and the Taliban.
Okay.
The hate of. The story of Zigud and Midgud brings down that it's Moshe Shem. Why would they say Moshe Shem? Doesn't sound like it.
Well, Moshe Shem is sometimes used to include Lashon Hara. I mean, it's lav dafka untrue. Meaning, you're saying bad things. You're putting a bad shame on somebody because you're only 1/8, so there's no toelus when you're coming to face. It would be Lashon Hara, but Moshe Shem is sometimes used to include Lashon Hara.
Because when you say Lashon Hara...
So there's Moshe Shem, whenever you give somebody a bad name, whether it's true or not true. But the other thing is, we would treat it like Moshe Shem, because since you're not believed, you're only one witness. Then we're not allowed to believe... So it is Moshe... No, this is Moshe Shem. Since we're not allowed to be Makabo Lashon Hara, then from our perspective, you said Moshe Shem. No, that's exactly right. You are misad you, it's Lashon Hara. Because you know it's true. Misad me, it's Moshe Shemra, because I'm not allowed to believe it. So yeah, so as a Beis Din, I'm hearing Moshe Shemra, even though you know it's Lashon Hara.
Beautiful. Also, in almost all the time when a person says Lashon Hara, he's a little bit off. He's not going to say it exactly.